Omaha Public Radio presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we'll hear a talk by James Duff, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Freedom Forum, a nonpartisan foundation dedicated to the First Amendment and media issues, and Chief Executive Officer of the Newseum, an interactive museum of history, news, and technology located in Washington, D.C. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, November 7, 2013, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Omaha Press Club, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Gary Willis, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
The Omaha Press Club welcomes James C. Duff. James is President and Chief Executive Officer of the Freedom Forum. It's the nonpartisan foundation dedicated to the First Amendment and media issues. He is also CEO of the Newseum. It's an interactive museum of history, news, and technology in Washington, D.C. Duff most recently served as the director of the administrative office in the U.S. courts from July 2006 to September 2011. He also served as secretary to the Judicial Conference of the United States. He was a member of the board of the Federal Judicial Center and was counselor to Chief Justice William Rehnquist. We introduce James Duff. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gary. I'm delighted to be back in Nebraska. I'm glad this is on radio. I've always been told I have a face for radio. And this is perfect. And I should mention the last time I was in Nebraska was I was working with Chief Justice Rehnquist at the time, and it was if you wanted to get Chief Justice Rehnquist to speak, you'd couple it with a football game and a college football game. So he wanted to go to the University of Nebraska football game, and we arranged it through my good friend Will Norton, and I see his daughter here today. And unfortunately, the week of the game was when the Chief Justice discovered his cancer in his throat, and he was already showing signs of illness from it at the time and certainly couldn't speak publicly as was scheduled. So I substituted for him. So it's a little bittersweet in a way to come back because it brings back those memories. But I was very well received, and even though I'm sure the audience was a bit disappointed to hear from me rather than the Chief Justice, but I'll never forget the warm reception that I received then. Well, I thought today I would talk a little bit about the topic that everyone seems to be talking about when it comes to Washington and our federal government, and give you maybe a little perspective from my standpoint. I've been in Washington now almost 40 years. The common refrain you hear when the subject comes up is Washington's broken. It's dysfunctional. It's a mess. And, you know, I think there are several things or issues that we are facing as a nation in Washington today that I'd like to put some perspective on. I first went to Washington in 1974 as an intern in Congress, and that was during Watergate summer. And it was a very exciting time to experience our government at work and to watch the media work at its finest. And since this is the Press Club, I'd like to weave in some remarks and observations about the media as well as the political situation in Washington. In 1974, when I arrived there as an intern, the boundaries of power were being tested in all three branches of government. And the issues centered around questions of abuse of that power. The media played a very crucial role in exposing the excesses of power coming from the executive branch at the time. The legislative branch was very actively engaged in conducting investigations. And the judicial branch played a very substantial and important role, and an impartial one, in ruling on the limits of executive privilege. The famous Nixon tapes case was argued on my 21st birthday, July 8, 1974, and I stood in line to hear that case, and never forget it. Little did I know at the time I'd be working at the court and periodically over the next 40 years for three different chief justices. But in 1974, many characterized the challenges we faced as a country as a constitutional crisis. But our Constitution and our system of government bore up very well under the test. Some say it performed at its best. And today, we face a very different kind of challenge. It's not an abuse of power that we face. It's an abdication of power and an abdication of the responsibilities that go with it. It's an abdication of power largely in the legislative branch, to some degree in the executive as well, but it puts added pressure, and some would say has ceded improper pressure and jurisdiction in the other gear of our government to fill that void, that being the judiciary. When I returned to work in Washington in 1975 after graduating from the University of Kentucky, I recall hearing people who worked on Capitol Hill say, you know, it used to be so much better when Mike Mansfield or LBJ would sit down with Everett Dirksen and they'd work things out. And then a few years later, I heard, you know, it used to be so much better when Howard Baker would sit down with Robert Byrd and they'd work things out. And then a few years later, I heard, you know, it used to be so much better when Trent Lott would sit down with Tom Daschle and work things out. And that's when I said, really? Are you? I mean, I don't remember that. Wait a minute. But I think from that historical perspective, there have always been tensions among the branches of government, and certainly there's a natural competitive tension between the political parties. The tensions among the branches of government were built into our system of checks and balances. And I've heard Justice Kennedy describe in very eloquent detail the genius of our framers who drew inspiration from the mechanical age and developing technologies from when they were living to draft a masterful system of integrated parts of government. Thomas Jefferson's fascination with the gears of clocks and the ways in which each gear moving separately but interlocking with the other gears empowered and enabled the singular instrument to work. And so our system of government was designed with those mechanics in mind. Justice Robert Jackson used the phrase separate but interdependent branches of government to describe the relationship among the three branches in the famous Steele seizure case. But for all the built-in tensions and the checks and balances in our system of government, there appears to be something more going on these days to clog those gears, and thus a crisis of a different nature confronts us. How do we unclog the gears of government? How do we persuade those who've been entrusted with the power that we've given them by our votes to use it, to exercise it, to get the job done? And I believe the answer lies within the very system itself, just as it did before and did in 1974 when I first went to Washington. And just as it has in years past, I think the media can play an important role in it too. Various theories have emerged in recent years as to why the gears are clogged. And I think, I'm sure you've heard some of them. For example, members of Congress no longer live in Washington with their families. They go home on the weekends. It's too expensive to live there. And as a result, they don't socialize with each other. The spouses and the families don't get together. There's less camaraderie. I think Chris Matthews has a new book out about President Reagan's and Tip O'Neill's relationship when, as he would have described it, two old Irishmen got together and things worked better. But I've also heard Brian Lamb discount that tale as a little bit exaggerated. He said that Reagan and O'Neill met only three or four times in 8 years and didn't particularly like each other. But Brian Lamb's theory is that there are fewer across-the-aisle relationships because there are fewer liberal Republicans and conservative Democrats, so there's less opportunity for cross-pollinization, if you will, and fewer opportunities for inter-party friendships, at least politically speaking. and therefore the current Congress is far more partisan and divided than ever before. Well, these are anecdotal observations by some, and there have been several attempts to measure the degree to which current partisanship compares historically. The Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania has published an analysis of civility in Congress as one criteria of partisanship, and it uses the number of striking down resolutions in Congress as a measure of civility. Striking down resolutions are resolutions that would strike remarks from the record because they were deemed inappropriate. And surprisingly, the last Congress was not among the highest-ranking ones for such resolutions. A new study is due out in the next few days, and I'm going to be very interested to see how the current Congress comes out in that. But the Annenberg Public Policy Center has been examining this over the Congresses, that is, over the last 76 years, and it notes that turnover Congresses are more likely to be less civil, more combustible, meaning they're likely more often to increase in incivility. A comparison of the language in various Congresses that elicit taking down objections reveals that the instances flagged in the past decade are really rather mild by comparison to those in earlier decades of the study, and they're less likely to include direct charges of hypocrisy than are instances, say, back in 1990 to 2000. Verbal attacks on the president captured in the taking down process did not really occur from the years 1935 to 1984. Those emerged in the last half of the 1980s. And some lines of attack that we've seen historically have largely fallen out of fashion. The assertions that a such and such member is clueless or ignorant or stupid was more likely to occur from 1935 to 1941 than in any period since then. But these, whether by any measurable standards such as these at the Annenberg Public Policy Center is used, it doesn't really matter about it, that historically. I think most people are of a mind that it's the partisanship has gone too far. There's certainly a public perception or sentiment that the level of civility in our public discourse is lower than what we would like. And so it may not matter exactly where this Congress ranks on that scale. I think what matters is that many of us and most of us are growing tired of it, particularly when the work that we really need as a nation is not getting done. Michael Gerson wrote in the Washington Post 2 years ago that while some stress the positives of polarization, that is, it encourages conviction, participation, and clear political choices, polarization complicates the task of governing, the kinds of actions needed for America to remain competitive as an economic power will be harsh enough without the cultivation of ideological rigidity and mutual disdain. That was 2 years ago, and I don't see things improving much since then. But regardless of rankings of this particular Congress, as I say, I think most people are of a mind that the decline in civility has gone far enough and we need different kind of action. I have two theories also to add to the mix of some of the causes, and maybe these theories can also, if we expose them and recognize them, can help us resolve the problem and step up to our role as individuals in the country as to what to do about it. There are two that I would observe since I've been in Washington. And first is, I believe there's been a very substantial growing influence on the legislative process created by the business of conflict. It's emerged both in our political systems and in the media. And that business of conflict perpetuates and profits from debate and inaction. And second, I also think there's a practice of blaming the opposing party. Both parties have been guilty of this, for being unable to get things done. That's been bred into the culture in Congress, and it encourages a sort of legislative laziness and excuses for not getting things done. And I see some good friends of mine from the federal judiciary here this afternoon, and they lived through this with me when I was at the administrative office of the courts, and we were trying to get some things done for the judiciary legislatively that were really very important to us but hit roadblocks from both parties as a result of that culture. Well, an entire industry has been built on conflict in Washington. And there is, of course, a very important First Amendment right to petition the government, and lobbying interests play a very vital role in exercising that right, and I wouldn't argue against the importance of that role at all. But the business of lobbying, and to a degree legislating and its impact on legislation, has evolved to a point that it must have that conflict to survive. The costs of running trade associations and other lobbying organizations are high, and they require membership support, and monetary support is dependent on issues that the organizations address. You've probably heard the story about a young lawyer moves back to his hometown. He hangs out a shingle. He's the only lawyer in town, and he's starving to death. And then a second lawyer moves to town, and they both make a fortune. They need each other and the conflict that they can generate for their business. And I think much the same can be said of these organizations. They need the conflict to survive. And if you ever want to watch money flow through Washington, just introduce a piece of legislation that affects an industry, and both sides really stake out their positions. And anecdotally, I remember when Chief Justice Roberts was going through his confirmation process, and he did such a wonderful job and had a relatively smooth ride. I remember remarking at the time, I don't care who the next nominee is, that person's going to get beaten up because nobody made any money off that confirmation hearing. The associations could not generate any money from their members because nobody really got so revved up about it. And that sure enough, when Justice Alito went through the process, it was much more acrimonious, and the camps carved out their positions, and they were probably happy about the money that generated, but I'm sure he wasn't very happy. Well, what about the media role in this? I think the same can be said for much of the media we see today. Fox News needs MSNBC News and vice versa. They generate money and support for those who are watching by staking out conflicting viewpoints and taking shots at each other. But, you know, what lobbying organizations need to succeed once in a while to help sustain their businesses. Otherwise, why pay to join them? And I think it is how that success is defined that perpetuates the standoffs, however. If you consider legislative achievements in the current administration, the most significant one being the Affordable Care Act, it did so on a budget reconciliation bill with no floor consideration and no input from the opposing party. And it was influenced by a great degree from groups that did not want input from the other side, and they managed to keep it out. Well, we're starting to see some of the repercussions of the fact that it wasn't compromised or worked on together, so much so that the party who lost on it wants to kill the whole bill. They don't want to revise it. They want to do away with it in its entirety, as opposed to working through the difficult differences that exist and finding the common ground that also exists in both camps in such important legislation that I think the country as a whole recognizes that we need. Well, it's become more difficult, I think, to get legislation through because of the second factor that I would suggest, and that is a culture of avoidance of the difficult work and the decisions that are needed to compromise. And that culture of abdication of power in the legislative branch began when I first arrived in Washington in a much different way, a less virulent way. It occurred through the process of legislation and with compromise, that being an essential element of almost any legislation. Rarely is there unanimity on any bill. But the result of compromise at times was ambiguous language in the statutes that they produced. And it was left up to the federal courts to resolve those ambiguities either through a plain meaning interpretation by some judges or legislative history analysis by others. Over time, however, at least since I've been observing this, the legislative branch began to avoid altogether the more difficult challenges of compromise and simply left harder decisions to the courts. In more recent years, this different culture has developed to a point in the Congress that it excuses inaction in legislation by blaming the opposing party for obstructing it, so much so that we see now, regardless which party is in power in the Senate, they're looking to have supermajorities, not simple majorities, to move any legislation. They don't want to get involved in filibusters, so they back away from legislation that otherwise might pass by simple majority. Any one of us in the room here who's ever worked through a disagreement with someone will tell you that that takes work. It's much easier to throw up your hands and say, I can't do it because so-and-so is opposing me. And blaming the other party is just a very simple excuse for not doing the work that needs to be done, rolling up your sleeves, getting down to business, and compromising. We had a recent event in Washington that I was really honored to attend. It was the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington, the civil rights speech, and the famous I Have a Dream speech by Dr. King down on the Mall at the Lincoln Memorial. And I was privileged to have a prime seat for that. And there were three presidents who spoke, and Dr. King's daughter spoke, and some very moving remarks were made. I don't know that any measured up to Dr. King's most famous speech. But the one remark that struck me most during that ceremony was President Clinton's remark that he said that, you know, I don't think Martin Luther King would have much patience or sympathy with the excuse of gridlock in Washington. So these people put their lives on the line to move the country in a direction that it needed to go. They were willing to risk their lives for that. And being backing away from needed and, by comparison, simple legislative tasks because of an inability or willingness to compromise is really not much of an excuse. And I think it's up to us to deliver that message to our representatives. The solution to the logjam rests with us, the people. We can't simply tolerate the inaction. Both political parties are guilty of it. And I would like to quote a couple of lines from former Congressman Lee Hamilton, who recently wrote a column warning that Congress must break the habit of governing by crisis. They need to remember that the essence of legislation is negotiation. And he goes on to point out that because in our system of government, power never evaporates, it just flows elsewhere. So when Congress doesn't perform, it cedes power to others. By its inaction, Congress has given power to the president, who can use executive actions to enact policy. And it's strengthened a federal bureaucracy by leaving regulatory decisions to federal agencies with very little direction or oversight. It's given massive economic power to the Federal Reserve, since someone has to promote economic growth in the face of congressional failure to deal with our fiscal issues. And it has allowed the Supreme Court to become the central policymaking body on controversial issues, from campaign finance to affirmative action to environmental regulation. He goes on to quote Justice Kennedy, who says, any society that relies on 9 unelected judges to resolve the most serious issues of the day is not a functioning democracy. And that's where we're looking at. where does the media stand in all this? I think it's been more complicit than it should be, in part because it profits from the conflicts too. But as to the journalists and the media's role, it strikes me as useful to bear in mind that while journalism serves a vitally important role in exposing corruption and abuses in power, and I've seen this recently in other developing countries where journalists today put their lives at stake and are killed for exposing corruption in countries like Mexico and the drug cartels. That's a very important role for journalists, continues to be an important role in the United States. But journalism and the media can also serve in a very important cohesive as a very important cohesive force in our society. A good friend of mine, Sid Udane, just passed away. He was 90 years old, and he established a newspaper on Capitol Hill in 1955 called Roll Call. And when he retired from Roll Call, which is a that's a local paper that reports on the comings and goings of the Capitol and its employees, he wrote that after getting to know and respecting the these dedicated people, I decided to establish a newspaper to serve that community, a paper that would be a cohesive force, a community instrument, a complement to an unfairly neglected segment of government. And he wrote that in 1988. I think there's a lot in that statement that we can draw upon to reignite the proper roles of our institutions and our media. And it's rooted in community service. We have the organization that I'm heading now, the Newseum and the Freedom Forum. We have an award winner every year, the Newhart Award, for journalists who have established through their careers great accomplishments. And the award winners have gone from everyone from Walter Cronkite to Brian Lamb to Katie Couric. Last year's award winner was Marilyn Haggerty. She is a journalist in North Dakota. She was about 88 years old. And she wrote a review in her local newspaper of the opening of the Olive Garden restaurant. And the review went viral. And we decided this is a great person to recognize and honor. And she said in her thank you remarks that when people see her name on this trophy with Walter Cronkite and Katie Couric, they're going to say, who the hell is Marilyn Haggerty? And the wonderful thing about her and about the award that year, I thought, in my mind, it was the greatest award ever given by the organization, was that she talked about how important a role she played in the community in bringing the community together. And there is a sense of that and a need of that, I think, that people are looking for in our media. If you look at public opinion polls today, Congress ranks as low as it ever has. The media ain't far behind. And I think people are a little tired of being able to predict what you're going to see or hear in the media by which channel you dial into. There is a bias that we're seeing in the media, and it's not entirely new. I mean, when the media first started in our country historically, it was biased. But I do think it trended to more objectivity, certainly in the 1900s, mid-1900s, and now it's trending in the other direction. And I think people are looking for something more objectivity in media, more news, more facts, and less opinion. And what they're getting from the media. And so I think the media can play an important role in some of the challenges that we face by getting back to the community service element of what it is that they do professionally and being more objective. I mentioned that I think people are a little fed up with what they're seeing and reading in the media. One of the measures of that, we do a State of the First Amendment survey in the Newseum every year, And this year, we found that 34% of those we surveyed believe that the press has too much freedom. Now, that is an alarming statistic, and I think it's in part generated by the public perception that much of our media has become biased, and they're inserting personal viewpoints into reporting rather than simply reporting the facts. And I think this may explain also why there's been so little public outcry over a recent study done by the Committee to Protect Journalists about the current White House's restrictions on disclosure of information. There's been very little outcry over that, in part, I think, because people aren't particularly concerned that the media is being harmed in any way. Well, that's a very slippery slope for us to get on with regard to our First Amendment principles. And so I'll conclude by saying, giving you a little idea of what we do at the museum and the Freedom Forum and our First Amendment Center there, and that is to educate the public about the value and the importance of the First Amendment and how crucial it is to our way of life. And I'll conclude with one story about that, a true story. A friend of mine was taking an acquaintance of his who's from Russia through our museum to see our exhibits and our artifacts. And he was soaking it all, his friend from Russia was soaking it all in. And as he was about halfway through the tour, he turned to my friend and he said, "You know, we have freedom of speech and freedom of press in Russia too. But the difference is, in America, you're free after you speak." And, there's a lot of truth, and it's a profound observation as to why that's the case. Many countries around the world have a Bill of Rights, but not many countries have a way of enforcing them. We have an independent judiciary. What happens if Congress does pass a law abridging freedom of speech, freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom to petition the government, freedom of assembly? That's the First Amendment. What happens if Congress passes a law like that? Well, in the United States, you can go to the judiciary, an independent judiciary, and get that law declared unconstitutional. And how do we have an independent judiciary? It's because we have an independent media and to protect and alert and educate the public about inequities, about the usurpation of power in one branch of the government over the other. It's a very, very unique and important element of the gears of our government and our independent media. And that's what we do at the museum. We try to educate the public about the value of that. We're sending materials out to the schools. And we brought a little video to show about the opening of our institution on Pennsylvania Avenue and where we're heading with regard to what we do. And with that, and then I'll open it up to questions and answers.
Special day for our nation and for its citizens. We have come together to dedicate this new institution and by doing so declare publicly and loudly our love and respect for the First Amendment, the North Star of journalism and of our freedom. The overarching goal was to shed a brighter light on our profession and also to create a venue where each new generation could learn the vital role the news media plays.
I think of visitors walking into this museum as reporters with their own notepad trying to learn the story of journalism.
You've heard and seen that this is the most interactive museum. It teaches by making it fun to participate. It is a place that, like good news reporting, offers you facts and opinions and alternatives and asks you to make up your own mind. When you practice free speech, you strengthen free speech. When you look at the West Berlin side of the wall and see a riot of graffiti, opinion, commentary, and free expression, and then look at the East Berlin side of the wall and see nothing, blank, gray, shut down. Those symbolic opposites form a museum teaching moment about freedom of expression and the spirit of liberty.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall. And the place erupted.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Journalists everywhere risk their lives when they go into these dangerous places to shine that bright light on truth. The Journalist Memorial here at the museum pays tribute to their sacrifices. They lost their lives so that we can find the truth.
The main and most vivid aspect of the museum is, of course, the inscription of the First Amendment on its exterior wall overlooking Pennsylvania Avenue.
The First Amendment is precious, almost sacred. It is the cornerstone of our democracy. It was the First Amendment that made the March on Washington, the march from Selma to Montgomery, the Freedom Ride possible.
My dear fellow clergymen, while confined here in the Birmingham City Jail, I came across your recent statement calling my present activities unwise and untimely.
We must come to see, with one of our distinguished jurors, that justice too long delayed is justice denied.
Yours for the cause of peace and brotherhood, Martin Luther King Jr.
I don't know where this nation would be. I don't know where I would be today without the guarantees of the First Amendment. And that's why it is so fitting and appropriate that this museum build to show the role of the press in our society and to the immutable principles embodied in the First Amendment.
What sets this place apart is that for all the history, the museum is about the present and about our future. Let everyone know that today, free speech has gained another voice. Welcome to the museum.
Got some questions here we'd like to start with. In terms of generating positive media for their own interests, what, in your opinion, has been the most successful and least successful lobbyist group?
It's most successful and least successful lobbyist group in what context? It was just in terms of... You'd have to say I thought the Trial Lawyers Association were very effective at keeping out any infiltration of tort reform into the Affordable Care Act. I think the NRA has certainly been very effective on Second Amendment issues. Those are two that come to mind immediately as having very actively involved. But there are so many in Washington. If you, as I mentioned earlier, there are, it is a real industry in Washington, D.C., and it's an important one. I don't suggest that it isn't important. What I've suggested is that it has overtaken, the conflicts that they are dependent upon for their purpose and existence have overtaken the ultimate ability, it seems, to get the jobs done and compromised accomplished, because they stake out positions and they don't want to budge from them. So,
okay, this question here, could you comment on how the proliferation of cable news has influenced political discourse? And in addition to that, I also do you feel that social media has played a part in that also?
I think the amount of information and material that we have available to us today is incredibly strong and good, and the more information, the better. The more transparency, the better. I think when it becomes so biased that it's predictable and not news reporting, that's a difference that we don't like. I'm not fond of seeing, but we really are living in a golden age of journalism. I've heard it described that way. A lot of people have been worried about the decline, certainly of newspapers, but many would say this is a golden age of information as far as what we have at our fingertips to get news and information. We just have to make sure that it's fair and accurate, and I think that's a challenge both from the media and from us as consumers, that we need to make that clear. One of our founders, Al Newhart, said that the First Amendment to the Constitution provides a free press. It's up to us to insist on a fair one. And so I think some of that responsibility falls back on us as consumers. But as far as the proliferation of cable stations and social media, it's phenomenal the way information can travel in a split second around the world these days. And that's good.
To kind of build on that also, are people confusing legitimate media with the untrustworthiness of Internet and Facebook?
Well, I think one of the things we've really decided to try to get involved in an educational way is digital literacy. That is challenging what you read and not accepting it on its face as being accurate necessarily. And I think young people face that challenge great. I mean, my generation, it's the who, what, when, where, why questions that you always asked either if you were a journalist before you wrote a story. And even if you were reading a story, you would ask it. But I think there is a risk in accepting as fact anything you pull up off the Internet or off Twitter accounts or Facebook. That how accurate is it? What are the what are the sources of the material? What is behind it? And we really want to get involved in a digital literacy campaign to teach students to question and ask the important questions as to be able to understand the authenticity or accuracy of any given story that they might have access to.
When President Obama threatened the job of a CNN reporter who criticized him, is this not a dangerous abuse of power by the executive?
Well, there have been, I'm sure presidents get frustrated by the questions that they get from reporters, and I'm sure all presidents have gone through a period of distaste for the media. I don't think it's unique to this president. I think what is perhaps a little different today is less sympathy for the media on the media side of it that's been generated by a skepticism that they are in part responsible for having created. I think it's important that we don't let any freedoms of press and that exchange, that very, very important exchange between the media and a president erode in any way. I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we remain a transparent those are words that I know he's used before, that the presidency is transparent and that they answer to reporters and questions. So I'm sure I'm not familiar with that particular incident, but I'm sure he was frustrated.
Are you worried about a decline in newspaper readership?
Well, it's interesting. One of your own here in Omaha has invested in papers, smaller papers, which I view as very, very heartening and interesting. And I'll go back to the comments I made about Marilyn Hagerty and our award winner last year for the Newhart Award and how important community papers are. I think there's a real future in that, and I think Mr. Buffett must believe that as well. But I think, just if you look back, people thought radio would put newspapers out of business, and people thought television would put newspapers out of business, and they've survived over the years. Maybe a little different now. Maybe they go to digital as opposed to the hard paper product. I hope that doesn't happen. I still enjoy reading the newspapers I get every day. I do think there is a real strong future for the local papers. I mean, what family doesn't like to see their children in their pictures in the paper, their sports achievements in the newspaper? That's the community service element of what I was alluding to earlier in my remarks. And I think there will remain a great future for that. And newspapers supply that. So I think there's still a future for newspapers.
Jim?
Yes, sir.
We added two new weeklies in Nebraska
last year. Alan Bierman just said that you've added two new weekly newspapers in Nebraska in the last year. So that I may have to invest, too.
What value do you put in public opinion polls?
It depends on the context and who's taking the poll and what the questions are, and is the poll biased itself? The questions can be biased. I think it's unfortunate to rely on people who are campaigning need polls and they rely on polls. I think it's most unfortunate to rely on polls to legislate. And I think we send our representatives there to get a job done, and if you get too hung up on reading the polls, and they can come out on a daily basis, if not certainly a weekly basis, if not a daily basis these days, to legislate based on polls is another abdication of power. And I don't mean to demean the polling industry. That's an important industry too, but I think it really does depend on who's conducting the poll, what the questions are. There can be biases built into poll data, and polls have been a lot of polls people have relied on over the certainly in recent years have been wrong, and so there are pluses and minuses in it, I think.
If the needed change is a Congress that is less devoted to partisan posturing, how can this be accomplished when congressional voting districts have become highly partisan, with most congressional seats being safe seats for either Democrat or Republicans?
That's the million-dollar question. It becomes harder and harder to vote people out for that reason, and I don't have the answer to that this afternoon. I'll work on it and come back and speak to you again, though. And if you can think of the answer, let's put it in motion. But that is a big problem in it. I mean, that's contributing, I think, to the problem, and that's relatively recent.
Could you discuss with us any memorable events while serving as counselor to Chief Justice William Rehnquist?
Well, he was a great man. And I would say, I don't know that there's any one thing, because they're just the best years that I've spent in Washington. They were by his side. He had a wonderful – he was brilliant, but he had a very strong dose of common sense. And that's a very rare combination. He's a very down-to-earth person. And I've heard Omaha described as sophisticated but down-to-earth, and that was William Rehnquist. He was I'll just give one example. When he presided over the impeachment trial, he did so in a way that he recognized – this was really – people were wondering how he would do that. And he was very good about at recognizing that this was a legislative proceeding. That is to say that the Constitution provides for Senate for – that the United States Senate conducts impeachment trials, not the judiciary, the United States Senate. And so when we went into that proceeding, we volunteered that we can run this like a trial in U.S. District Court, or it's up to you how to conduct the trial. What process, what procedures do you want to use? We can use, we can set up discovery schedule and depositions and like you would run a federal district court trial, or how do you want to run it? And the Senate came up with their own process and procedures, as they are entitled to do and did, very different from federal court procedures. And the Chief Justice presided over that as they had designed, in a very impartial way, and at the end of it was widely acclaimed by both parties as having presided in a very, very impartial way. But he was a brilliant man and a lot of fun stuff. I'll tell you, do I have time for one more story? He went to New Orleans, and it was giving some remarks down in New Orleans, and he was staying in a hotel on Saturday night, and he asked the concierge, where's the nearest Lutheran church? And New Orleans, I don't think there are very many Lutheran churches in New Orleans, but they pointed him to one. And so he went to church service on Sunday morning. And the minister there had the practice of recognizing visitors. And so he saw Chief Justice Rehnquist in the audience, or the congregation, I should say, and he said, I see we have a visitor this morning. Would you mind standing up and giving us your name? So the Chief Justice stood up, and he said, I'm Bill Rehnquist. And he said, well, thank you very much, Mr. Rehnquist. It's nice to have you with us this morning. Where are you from? He said, well, I'm from Washington, D.C. And he said, that's great. He said, what do you do? And he said, I'm a government lawyer.
Okay. Our last question is regards to the museum. Are there any – we saw the intro and everything that was, discussed on that. Is there any highlights that you would like to bring to our attention before we close?
Well, you're nice to ask. We have permanent exhibits that you saw, like the Berlin Wall. We have a 9/11 exhibit, but we also, part of our lifeblood there, are rotating exhibits. We have right now an exhibit that on the Civil Rights March 50-year anniversary that is a wonderful educational tool for us because we can talk about all five freedoms in the First Amendment: freedom of religion, freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom to petition the government, freedom of speech, because all five of those freedoms were exercised in the civil rights movement. The movement started among churches for the most part. And freedom of religion enabled that. And you heard John Lewis speak about where he would be. He didn't know where he would be if it weren't for the First Amendment. That's a very educational exhibit for us. We have an exhibit on the anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination, the 50-year anniversary on that. And then we've got the big blockbuster coming up, Anchorman 2, Will Ferrell's new movie. We're going to have a premiere showing in December of Anchorman 2. So that's we got both ends of the spectrum covered, I think, by having that. But I'm delighted to have been here with you today, and thank you for this opportunity, Gary. I appreciate it.
Thank you. James, thank you.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club on Noon Forum. On today's program, we've heard a talk by James Duff, President and Chief Executive Officer of the Freedom Forum, a nonpartisan foundation dedicated to the First Amendment and media issues, and Chief Executive Officer of the Newseum, an interactive museum of history, news, and technology located in Washington, D.C. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday afternoon, November 7, 2013, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club presents these noontime educational forums each month. The next program will be this Thursday, November 21st at 12 noon. At that time, the guest speaker will be the Honorable Tom Hanifin, Mayor of the City of Council Bluffs, Iowa. He'll talk about his nearly 28 years as mayor and what he considers his most important accomplishments during that time. Mr. Hanifin will retire from the office of mayor in January. If you'd like to attend this or other future programs in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 402-345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge in downtown Omaha. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.